Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. I'm here today with Frank Rieta, founder and CEO of Rieta.com, a security-focused web application firm. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you here. And I want to say you're one of my favorite, one of my two favorite redheaded Italians.
Hey, that's an accomplishment. There aren't very many of us, but I appreciate it.
The only other one I can think of is Mario Batali.
Okay. Well, actually, believe it or not, there are more redheaded Italians than you would know. I hear. I have some family that's really into that genealogy stuff. And it goes way, way, way back to some of the occupations and things. But that's ancient history.
Yeah. Yeah. That is when the call started, I looked at you and I was like, Frank Rieta, but you look like you're Irish, but you're apparently Italian. So apparently redheaded Italians do exist.
Well, my name's obviously Italian. I'm technically half Italian. My mom's family has actually been in what's now the United States since well before the American Revolution. At one point traced our relatives all the way back to, at least on the male side, the fortune, which came after the Mayflower. But he married, I think William Bompas, married one of a lady who was one of the daughters of a family that was on the Mayflower. So we go way back, apparently.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty, yeah, I've never looked into my genealogy that much. I think I'm English, which is like the most boring heritage a person can have, basically.
Sure.
I don't know when we came over here, but that's pretty interesting. You came over so long ago. But I think I just set a new record for like getting us off topic so quickly and just so incredibly far afield. Like, what could have less to do with Ruby on Rails than all that
stuff? American all the way, baby.
Yeah. Anyway, I wanted to talk with you this time. You and I did an episode sometime back where we talked about security, because that's kind of your thing. What I'd like to talk about today is some more security stuff, but specifically, I'm curious, when you work with your clients, what kind of projects do you do? What kind of clients do you have? Basically, how does it all go? Because I'm familiar with Rails Consulting, building custom web applications for businesses. We all kind of know how that goes. But what is it like for a security-focused agency? So can you paint that picture for us a little bit?
Well, I would say about 95% of it is exactly what you would think. You know, build me an app. Can you update my app to do some things?
Well,
as far as our client base, and the reason for this, right, is by and large, security is an attribute, right? So I would like for my application to not get compromised. However, it still has to do something. And just possibly an accident of how this company came to be. You know, we are not predominantly, say, a pen test firm. We're not, I mean, I do some audit work. I have an engagement that's beginning soon. I have been called to be an expert witness, you know, to, you know, some credibility from years of experience, turning that into, you know, looking over a Git repo, analyzing the situation and preparing written testimony in a legal dispute between, you know, parties. And then certainly from a security standpoint, like, hey, we get to talk about the OWASP Top 10, the ASVS, do code reviews. And we can talk more about that later. but a lot of the work really just is straight up Rails development. I would say one of the things that this focus attracts, however, is companies and organizations that had a Rails shop build them an application at some time in the past. And now that original developer has moved on to other things because, you know, that's what developers tend to do. And so now they have to support this application for the long haul, and they have security mandates. So we have several state government agencies from different states where some web dev firm built them a Rails application, and now they have to maintain it. And so they looked for us. They looked to my company, knowing both Rails and security, as being able to provide those services. And then occasionally you'll get a really fun hardened feature development where it's like, we need this thing to do encryption or do this other thing that is not common knowledge amongst devs. One of the interesting clients, let me see, I jotted this down just so I could say things in an appropriately generic way, not betraying confidences. They have a lot of IoT devices. You know, they sell them in places like Home Depot's and Lowe's. And they had a big launch, and some of their infrastructure runs on Heroku and a Rails app. And so the vice president of engineering literally was searching for Rails security experts. Apparently watched one of my videos where I was guest lecturing for a boot camp and was like, we need this guy in here. And now nearly 5 years later, I'm still consulting with them across their entire product line, making sure security is part of the engineering process. So it's kind of all over the map. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's an interesting niche, no doubt.
Yeah. There's so many directions we could take that. First of all, it's interesting to understand that although there's a security focus, there is a lot of Rails development involved. Something I'm curious about is this. So in order for an agency client relationship to exist, the client must be the kind of client that for some reason wants to use an agency. They either don't want to have their own developers, or they don't want to completely have their own developers, which might be just a temporary thing. They might be planning to go completely in-house at some point in the future, or they just might want to have that client-vendor relationship in perpetuity. So I'm curious about some of your clients. What is that picture like? Do they have a team of their own, and you're kind of interfacing with their team and being part of their team, or do they totally just have you? And if so, why do they not want to have their own developers? Why do they want to use you instead?
I would say there is a mix. There is certainly a mix. Some of our clients certainly do have their own devs, and we are providing, you know, specialized service for a certain feature, or, you know, just based on the experience. For others, I would say as an agency, believe it or not, this is especially true for our government clients. They do not want a developer on salary because that's really hard for them to do. They want a support contract that goes on for years and years. And this is often because the IT director or whomever has the ability, who needs the work done, has zero budgetary authority without having some committee approve it. So they can say, okay, we have this app and it was written, I don't know, 5 years ago. It is irresponsible to leave it out there unupdated. But I need a support contract to be able to get whatever agency above me approves these things. And so they come up with their approved annual budget, and it becomes like a monthly retainer where the IT person can actually direct us to work on what they need, even though they could never sign a contract for a capital expenditure for dev.
Interesting.
That's obviously one niche. The others, there are plenty of companies with applications in production where their annual budget to run it, which is substantial. I mean, right? I mean, imagine you had a mortgage payment or a lease on a building. It could be, you know, for a small office, could be much like a house, right? $1,200, $2,000, something like that. Well, that's only $24,000 a year. That is less than a third of what you need to hire a developer, yet it's a substantial sum of money. And so organizations like that will look to an agency like ours, which has a model to actually maintain. We have, you know, a developer to client ratio that lets us cross train and support these maintenance clients at a figure below which they could afford to hire their own staff developer all the time.
Oh, that makes sense, because they don't have all the overhead of having their own employees.
And it's not just overhead, it's just fractional, right? Like, you can't actually afford one third of a full-time developer and ensure that that person is available to come work for you in your time of need when you need something done, you know, this week.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I was more imagining
right?
The model of like them hiring you for one developer to work with them full time, blah, blah, blah. But they have, like you said, not a full time need, something less than that.
Correct. That's just one part of the business. We have, if you go to our website, rieta.com, we have a page on maintenance. We actually have the concept of pillars, like the five pillars of our business. And one of the reasons that I'm very bullish on maintenance is that you can't do security without doing long-term maintenance. Right. So one number I've heard thrown around, 63% of data breaches, this is a 4-year-old number, is about usernames and passwords. And that's changed slightly, but the vast majority of the rest of it's just straight not updating your dependencies. There's a mailing list announcement, you know, that this Ruby gem is vulnerable. But how do you update that if you don't have any developers? How do you update that quickly if your site has fallen into a state of disrepair? So you have to do long-term maintenance in order to do security.
All right,
and there's,
I'm gonna ask you,
for all the organizations that can afford a staff, there are hundreds or thousands who can't afford more than, you know, $20,000, $30,000 a year at the utter max. And that's really hard to staff professional devs at that level.
I'm going to ask you a really naive question, which is, why is a failure to update your dependencies and all that stuff a security risk?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. There's a concept of CVEs. It stands for Common Vulnerabilities and Exploits. Let me make sure I said that right. CVE. I usually say, and exposures. I'm sorry. It's one of those acronyms that you say the acronym more often than the full-fledged version. What happens with a CVE is what will happen is your dependencies and your dependencies' dependencies form part of your supply chain. And there's a major issue in that, let's say you have a Ruby on Rails application and it uses Nokugiri. So many of us use Nokugiri. Well, from time to time, there has been a XML parser vulnerability that has become well known. And if you don't update your version of Nokugiri, an attacker can actually use that vulnerability to hack your server. And so it becomes a race against time to update it. I recently gave a talk at an application security conference called Snowfrock in Denver. And in that talk, I discussed some of the statistics. A company called... One moment. There was an analysis done a few years ago of how long it took a company of any size to patch a security vulnerability of any size, and the average number of days was 34 or more days.
Wow.
Which is plenty of time to get hacked. And that's for a company that's staffed and ready to go. That's just how long it takes on average to make a change of any sort to production. The truth is there are hundreds, there are many, many websites out there in written in Ruby on Rails where the devs moved on to greener pastures and the owners of the websites have no idea that they're sitting ducks for cyber attacks.
Hang on, I want to focus on this one part for just a minute because it's so crazy and I think so important. You said 34 days or something like that. What do you think is, and I have my own ideas, but I want to hear what you think. Why do you think that is, that it's so long that they can only, it takes them 34 days to make a change?
For a good company or a company that doesn't have devs?
Oh, for a good company.
Okay. Well, one thing that happens is there is no one around to do any work. Just because they have devs doesn't mean the devs haven't moved on to another project. That's one aspect. Another aspect is change is downright hard. Most enterprise software, if it was developed with test-driven development, is in the minority. So they have no good way of running an automated test suite and prove that everything is still working in the face of change. So once you went and found a dev that was no longer working on your project because you closed the capital budget, they have to make a change, and now you have to test it, and that's usually a manual process, and the deployment is a manual process, and just this long chain of delays add together to take a very long time. There's lots of reasons, but those are some of the top ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked at this startup in like 2015, 2016. They had a pretty bad situation. The people I worked with were pretty smart for the most part, but they just like inherited this bad situation. They had a really long cycle time. The code was really low quality, and so it would take a really long time to do anything just because it took a super long time to understand the area of code in which you were trying to make a change. And so it would take a number of days just to implement a pretty trivial feature. And then because everything was so fragile, they had a very rigorous QA process. I don't know how rigorous it was, but it was at least a lengthy QA process before deployment happened. And because all these things were true, and because their deployments were so painful because of this long QA process and all that, they deployed fairly infrequently. And because they deployed infrequently, it meant there was more stuff to QA before each deployment. And they found more stuff that was wrong, so we would have to postpone the deployment and go back and fix stuff, start the QA process over again, blah, blah, blah. So we only got releases out once every several weeks in my memory. And often things went wrong when we released. It was really painful. And so what never occurred to me is that this is not only bad just because that's bad, but it's also bad because what if you need to get some kind of a update out for security purposes? That's going to be, you know, if you only get a release out once every 6 weeks in the best case, then that's a 6 week window for the hackers to do their hacking. That seems pretty bad.
It is. And I hate to name drop, but this is basically what happened to Equifax with the Equifax hack. So
tell us about the Equifax hack. I'm peripherally aware of it, but I don't really know about it that much.
All I want to say just off the top of my head, because I don't want to mislead anyone, is that the principal cause was blamed on failure to patch a Apache Struts vulnerability. So the software they built ran on Apache Struts, kind of like, you know, Ruby on Rails is a framework, Apache Struts is a framework. And they didn't patch it in time, and it was exploited. But this was an old vulnerability, and the update had been generally available for quite some time, and they simply hadn't updated their production servers. I could get further into defense in depth and bad design and why all this was in a database accessible by a web server in the first place, but let's just leave it for there for now.
Yeah, I'm really curious about this. So I think we've like hit on a pretty interesting topic of like dependencies and keeping them updated and stuff, because it seems pretty simple on the surface, but it's kind of not that simple, because like you would
think... No, not at all. Change is really hard.
Yeah, yeah. From a naive perspective, it's like, well, just gem update, blah, 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 and there you go. But no, it's not that simple. And the reason it's not that simple is because... What a change from an old version to a new version of something can break some functionality, and it might break without your knowledge, and so you have to somehow find out about the breakage, and the finding out about that breakage is not that easy, right?
And many environments, no, it is not. So you know, once you just run for anyone who's run bundle update for hey, bundle update, let's update all the things. More times than not, if it's not just a minor change, things are going to break. And things are going to break in unexpected ways. And in the Ruby community, the Ruby community has really bought into, solid test coverage and test-driven development. But we got to remember, that's a minority position in professional software right now.
Yeah, and even in Rails, I don't know if it's minority, but in my experience, most Rails applications, on the dozens of Rails applications I've worked on in my career, very few of them have had what I would call good test coverage.
Sure, robust test coverage. Yeah. Another thing is just simply it's the, a lot of open source projects are maintained by volunteers, right? Especially if you use a lot of open source, and rigorous backwards compatibility is not a desirable trait necessarily, or it's not an interesting trait. And so there's certainly a keep up with the Joneses that happens in a open source stack that you really don't have necessarily if you're an enterprise that's used to building on top of Microsoft, which will support it for 10 years or more.
That's an interesting difference. And a question that's occurring to me is, let's say you have a gem that you depend on. Maybe it's a relatively obscure one, and it develops some kind of security vulnerability becomes known. But the maintainer of that gem, for whatever reason, is not taking the necessary action to plug that security hole or however you phrase it. And so you can't just do a gem update because there is no updated gem. My first question is that something that actually happens? I assume it must be. And then my second question is, what do you do in that situation?
Okay. There's a couple of questions you packed into one. So let's break that apart for a moment. So there becomes a known vulnerability of a, let's just call it an abandoned gem. Okay, so for one, open source is wonderful. So, one thing I would always say is try to do a pull request. So you're going to have to change code yourself, right? Especially if you have the sophistication to know this. So that's one thing, right? So you go ahead, and we've certainly done that as a company. Not so much a security vulnerability, but we had the need to implement 2FA, and there was a gem called Devise 2FA. Surveyed the different ones, and it was kind of the best of them. But for our purposes as a security firm, the implementation didn't quite meet the actual spec, and so we actually did the work to improve that gem and issue a pull request that ultimately got merged into the gem. But there was a time, actually, I don't know, it was a period of a month or more, because even though that gem is well-maintained, it's still a volunteer open source contributor. It took them a little while to get around to it. So in the meantime, we actually were using our own private fork from our GitHub. In this case, it was open source fork. So the fork itself wasn't private. But and we were using that in our production until it became part of the main one. So in an open source space, if it matters to you enough, you have to be willing to contribute.
Yeah, because in a way, all the code and all your dependencies is your application code, because it's running in your application. And you kind of have to be willing to be responsible for all of it.
Which is one of the reasons, this isn't your original question, but I'm going to say this. As a security-focused developer, one of the things that we spend some time talking with our new developers who join our company about, who maybe came from a more traditional background of there's a gem for everything, is unless it hurts, don't use a gem. And you're probably going to have, if everyone listening is probably like, wait, what are you talking about? Of course you use a gem. No. Every time you use a third-party dependency, you are creating a liability. You're creating a third-party entanglement. So one of the principles is, if you're going to use a gem, make sure it's worth it. So for example, I'm not going to use Rails. I'm not going to use Devise. But if I'm using some Ruby version of Leftpad, which is just a loop and a couple lines of code, or I'm using a gem and only using a very tiny function from it, then by our coding standards, we'll actually implement that in native Ruby and make it part of the application to minimize that third-party dependency and thus minimize the chances that we have a security issue related to that third-party dependency.
Yeah, that seems like a smart way to think about it. And I've been thinking about that more and more recently, which is like there's kind of a mindset that's pretty common where it's like if you need some functionality and there's a gem that already does it, you're being stupid by not just using that gem. You're reinventing the wheel. But it's not quite as simple as that. It's not as if it costs something to reinvent the wheel and it's free to use a gem. It's not free to use a gem because you have the cost of the burden of staying on top of the updates and all that kind of stuff and the cost of the added vulnerability. Is that kind of how you think about it?
And you have another cost. There are legitimate gems that have become malicious. This has happened several times last year. We actually covered it on our blog. And that's something I'm talking about more. Is it happens a couple ways. A maintainer's account becomes overtaken by a malicious party who updates the gem maliciously with actual malicious code. And now you come around and blindly update it, or worse, your CI/CD just updates it, and now you have a vulnerability where none existed before. There's also been attacks that are sound-alike gems, which means, you know, awesome gem. There would be like awesome gem NG for next generation. It's meant to fool developers who just heard a name and are looking for it. So that's an active area of research right now for me. I'm doing data analysis of Ruby gems looking for these situations. It has happened in the past and it will happen again. So
wow. The world is a hostile, dangerous place.
It truly is. And not so much in the Ruby ecosystem, but it has happened in browser extensions. A browser extension gets very popular, and the maintainer becomes tired of maintaining it. And from time to time, someone will offer money to take it over. But it turns out that the person offering the money wasn't altruistic about it and intended to update it in a way that was minimally privacy invading or possibly very malicious instead to distribute it to the existing user base of that plugin.
Okay, so my next naive question, who are these people who offer money to hackers to take over these browser extensions and stuff like that? Who are they?
I mean, basically cybercrime is big business.
I mean, let me ask it a different way. Like, you know, different people or whatever have different motivations for doing that, of course. Can you give us maybe a couple examples of what kinds of scenarios exist?
Well, I'm going to turn a little bit to the academics just because I don't have like a cheat sheet right in front of me. But in general, you look at different actors and what their motivations are. There is certainly a component of organized crime that wants to steal money or Bitcoin or whatever. There's also fraud rings where PII is very valuable, right? It allows them to conduct identity theft.
PII meaning personally identifiable information?
Exactly. So there's a financial motive there. So I think our audience is going to be fairly familiar with the concept of ransomware. These attacks happen where malicious software gets infiltrated into an environment at a hospital or a government agency, and it encrypts all the files and they demand ransom because they want money. They literally it's for profit. Now, some of these attacks have been carried out by state actors. Like the Sony hacking was actually North Korea. You know, North Korea as a country is
there.
I'm sorry, say
a joke. I said they have computers there.
They sure do, and especially they do it for state purposes. There have been other attacks attributed to other state actors, and anyone who is interested should search through the news and dig into it. It's a very fascinating area.
By the way, I just realized that I just offended my entire North Korea constituency, so. I apologize, dear North Korean listeners. That was not directed at you personally.
The point, right? I mean, so, you know, all these countries, most countries in the world have a military purpose for having defensive and offensive cybersecurity capabilities. And
yeah,
our
I'm
country
sorry.
Has it as
what
well.
What was the Sony hack? I heard about it, didn't pay much attention. What was the deal with that?
From what I recall, and it has been quite some time since I've read the account of this, what I believe was said was that the North Korean government was unhappy with a particular movie that was making fun of them.
Oh, yeah, The Interview.
Yep, and so they attacked Sony, and Sony's security was not sufficient to withstand a nation state attacker that has dozens of full time personnel dedicated to cyber attack.
I remember this now. They hacked Sony because Sony put out a movie they didn't like. How insane is that? That's so crazy.
And that's not the only motivation. You hear other attacks attributed to other state actors, you know, Iran, Russia, you know, various state actors have variously been attributed to various attacks.
Yeah, I was reading the other day about the Stuxnet worm, which I found out about that a long time ago, but I was telling the story to my kids. You know about that one, right?
I do, yes. That was, as far as I know, the first kinetic cyber weapon that actually blew something up in real life.
Yeah, I like that wording, kinetic cyber weapon.
So we're getting a little bit beyond like my actual area of expertise. I certainly read these accounts myself in the media and track it. But if we want to kind of steer back towards, you know, Ruby development, I'd be happy to go that.
Let's steer back, but first, I don't want to let go of the Stuxnet thing for a minute, because even if it might not be your expert area of expertise, and it's certainly not mine, I want to tell the story a little bit because it's so crazy. And my story, my version will be totally like inaccurate. So go look this up later if it sounds interesting. But basically, the U.S. and Israel jointly developed this worm, and I don't really understand the distinction between a worm and a virus, but they put this thing on some Iranian computers around 2009 or something like that, because Iran was of course attempting to develop nuclear weapons, and they had this centrifuge that was enriching uranium, something like that. And this worm sounded really sophisticated, like it took a recording of the video that monitored the centrifuge and replayed it in a loop so that the people monitoring the centrifuge thought they were watching a live feed of the centrifuge, but really
I believe it wasn't necessarily like a video, like a security camera, but it was the sensor data. But yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. And so they tricked the people who were watching it, and they made the centrifuge like spin ever so slightly too fast. I don't know the story, but eventually like the thing went kablooey or something. Maybe you have a better version of the story than I remember.
That's it. Another aspect of it is the Iranian facility actually had good security in the form of what's called an air gap, which means that their internal computers were not connected at all to the internet. And so the Stuxnet virus actually was designed to spread like on USB sticks or whatever. It jumped the air gap in order to pull this off. I mean, it's anyone who's interested should read some of the accounts. It is fascinating history.
Yeah, that book is now on my mental to-read list, because that question occurred to me, like, how did they get the worm physically onto the computer? Did they have a spy go in there and do it? And if not, how did they do it?
No, one of the reasons they used a virus that spread is they had to get it in proximity to the facility, but have it spread on its own to actually jump the gap.
Yeah, like so nuts.
Like, this is why security researchers sometimes will do a drop where they'll put like a fascinating looking USB device like out in the smoking area at a building, and then the idea is who plugs it into their computer, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, wow.
You get these things called a rubber duck, which will emulate a human input device in addition to a drive. Because it turns out that computers implicitly trust human input devices. Well, what does that mean? So you have a little card that just looks like a USB memory stick, but when you plug it in, the computer sees it as not only storage, but also a keyboard, and it actually types the script that like pops a command shell and runs something like lickety-split really fast. And next thing you know, it's hacked you.
Oh, wow. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's called a rubber ducky. You can actually search them. They are commercially available for system administrative purposes.
Man, again, the world is a dangerous and nefarious place. I'm appalled. Okay, so steering us back to the stuff that we're talking about.
I wanted to get at when I mentioned ransomware is, and the history of malicious code that has impacted Ruby gems. Specifically, I'll use an example. REST client last year had a malicious release. We covered it on our blog. I'm friends with one of the maintainers, and they did their best, to manage that. But you know, bad things happened. It got undone. But there was a time that if you had upgraded to the malicious REST client, which was an updated version of an old version, so it may have been specifically targeted, or it may have just hoped to go undetected for a time. There was a way for the attacker to set a malicious cookie that then got executed, remote execution. It was a use of eval, where any code they wished ran as your user. It means they could have dumped environment variables. They could have done anything. They could complete pwnage. I've not seen it before, but there could exist that sort of attack could do a ransomware that actually encrypts a Rails applications database. There's nothing technically that stops that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that would be a tough situation to be in. Okay, so sometimes it's state actors, sometimes there's organized crime. Another thing that I've always wondered is, how do hackers stay anonymous? How do they cover their trail? It seems like a huge risk to the hacker if they get found out doing this stuff.
A lot of them don't cover their trail so well. But a lot of times they don't have to cover their trail so well because for most victims. Most of us don't have sufficient logging and monitoring to even be able to turn any evidence over to the appropriate authorities. So they don't really have to hide so hard because we're not even logging or monitoring to catch them.
Okay. Yeah, and I suppose a lot of the victims wouldn't even have the level of sophistication to know where to begin.
Bigger organizations do, and they'll hire what's called DFIR, Digital Forensics Incident Response. There's an entire industry of experts and consultants in that space. But for the smaller company, most of them, it's just like, hey, can we restore from backup? How do we get our WordPress site back up? They're just not that sophisticated.
Yeah. Okay, man. All right. So what should we, now that like I'm thoroughly made nervous by all of this stuff, what would be your advice to just your average Rails maintainer for some like basic security practices that they could engage in? Sounds like one obviously is like keep your gems updated, don't use gems where you don't have to, and like somehow maybe keep an eye out for maliciously updated gems, although I don't know how you do that. But what advice do you have for the average person?
One moment, I'm going to find something real quick because we're kind of free ranging it. I actually had a presentation that is very related.
Okay.
I can't find.
Okay. And while you're finding that, I will fill the time by talking about something completely unrelated. Over the last few days, I built this really cool Lego Technic car for my kids. I hooked up the first challenge was I made steering for it, and I had to figure out, because it's remote controlled, I had to figure out how to make the steering return to center when you turn the motor off. So I hooked up this thing where I got these rubber bands, and I hooked up rubber bands to the steering, and I had a mechanism that made it come back to center, and that worked. But then it didn't turn so good because the rear axle didn't have a differential, so I added one. Now it's all hooked up and it works pretty good. Anyway, I just had to think of something random to talk about for a minute. Did you find
it? Yeah. Right. So I'm gonna run through this really fast because I want to give a robust answer so that our listeners have a solid foundation to start with. So for number one, I would say to the greatest extent possible, practice test-driven development so that you have a thorough test suite that exercises your application. And I'm about to tell you why. Because the biggest thing you can do the as far as patching quickly is to be able to get to the point where you can deploy to production without human intervention as soon as the tests pass. That's number one. Most people aren't there, but the closer you can get, the better. That is a lot easier if you have a multi-user development team. You want to turn on protected branches in your Git. So, like for example, you want to go ahead and mark the master branch as protected and require a code review by someone else. Now, what the code review?
Okay, so that's what you mean by multi-user development team. Like nobody can merge something in.
Like it's not just you. There's like maybe a couple devs.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So when you're in that situation, what you want to do is not allow anyone to push directly to master and go through pull requests. So when I do a pull request review, I'm going to have what's called CI run. And CI is going to do a couple things. One, it's going to run all of my tests. And then I'm going to have it also run a gem called Brakeman and another gem called Bundler Audit. Brakeman is called a SAST. It's going to scan through the Rails application and it's going to flag things that are likely dangerous. Sometimes it gets things wrong, but a lot of times it's right. And if you don't have a good articulatable reason that it's a false positive, you should assume this is something that you have to fix. So you should treat a Brakeman failure as a failing test.
That's interesting. I thought Brakeman was something else. So just for the record, what is it exactly?
It's called a static analysis tool, SAST. And what it does is it does source code analysis of your Rails application to flag dangerous and vulnerable coding patterns that are known to cause software security vulnerabilities in Ruby and Rails applications.
Okay.
Okay. There's a related tool called Bundler Audit. And what Bundler Audit does is it checks your gems and your gems gems, so your dependencies and your dependencies dependencies. And it flags them if there are known CVEs published against the versions in your application. So that gives you an early warning sign that you need to update your Ruby gems.
Yeah, I recently found out about that one myself, and I ran it against my app, and I found a handful of gems that needed updating. So that was really cool. I think you can just do, if it's in my bash history here.
Yep, yeah, you can do it locally. You can just run bundle audit. And it will do it. What I like about having this in CI and running nightly is it just helps make sure the whole team, again, when you're working on your own, you can do it yourself. When you start working with two or three or four other devs, you start wanting to have checks and balances between you.
And why? Why do you want to have checks and balances?
I'm sorry, go on.
Why do you want to have checks and balances?
To make the output of the team stronger, right? So, you know, for example, in our company, code is reviewed by another developer. So even I, barring some massively unusual situation, do not approve my own pull requests. In fact, I have to like go and disable some feature to let me do it, even though I own the whole account. Because it just keeps one, what's good for the team is good for me. And you know, sometimes I make mistakes, and having another developer look over the code and make several assertions. Does the code, you know, look to be good code of, you know, no unreasonable smells? Does it appear to implement the functionality requested in the user story? Did the developer write automated tests that on their face appear to exercise the functionality thoroughly?
That's one of the things that I found most helpful. Even for me, who's big time in the habit of writing tests for almost anything, at this place I used to work, I remember one specific occasion where I submitted a PR. It was like some little thing that was just a couple lines, and somebody commented on it, and they're like, "This looks good, but like, you're not going to write a test?" And I'm like, "Fuck! I'll just write a test," because you know I got lazy, and he called me out on my laziness, and so that's really helpful.
And the idea is to have this ever-growing body of automated tests, which comes into the next steps. We mentioned minimized dependencies. Like if it doesn't provide substantial value, just realize that a third-party dependency is not free, and try to implement that functionality yourself, or you know, just have some code that does it.
Yeah, and I was trying to like formulate that into a if this then that kind of thing in my head. And I guess the thing is, if the cost of using the gem is more than the cost of implementing it yourself, then just implement it yourself.
Right. I use the 1 hour test, more or less. Like, does it take you less than an hour to implement it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just arbitrarily chosen. People can choose different things, but you know, just have a line in the sand. It's one of these things that takes wisdom, right? Like, I can't tell you a hard and fast rule, but you know, just be wise about it. Yeah, so let me build the cost if you're truly being secure. So let's talk about the gems that you do choose to use. Carefully review the libraries that you do choose to include. Consider the age and number of downloads. So something that's very new or very niche may sway you to stay away. Search for variations and see if it appears to be squatted on a typo for a more popular package. So you need to do a little research in RubyGem. And there is some safety in waiting to upgrade to a new release unless you must upgrade to patch a known CVE. Basically, you're trying to delay jumping to the latest version to allow for it to be someone to pull the alarm that this is actually a malicious update if you're not doing the actual code review of your dependency itself.
Yeah, if it is a malicious update, you don't want to be the first person to update to it.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
I would say in Ruby, avoid using the spermy operator, the tilde, the one that just basically avoid using the ones that bump your versions, but be more specific about what version that you're on, and then update very specifically instead of as a block. That helps. That's a practical step. It increases the friction to updating, but it protects you against some of the inadvertent bumps that can implement that can lead to breaking changes.
Okay, so actually hard code the version x.x.x instead of x.x and whatever.
If the application needs to be a secure application, absolutely. You need to be very intentional about your dependencies. It's not that you don't update them, but you don't want to just jump to a new version without going through your review process to make sure that that version is acceptable given your organization's risk.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And I would say some of the principles that really apply to all platforms. So not just Ruby Gems, but NPM to the Microsoft.NET stuff is we talked a little bit of what in the trades are called the software supply chain. And so these supply chain attacks have been one of the big trends in cybercrime. So it's been happening. And it's important to know that just because a library is trustworthy today does not actually mean that the next published version will not contain vulnerabilities of malicious code. Again, it was best to wait a little bit before upgrading to the absolute latest unless it is necessary to fix a known published vulnerability. And so we talked about this for Ruby Gems, but the same is true for Node, for NPM, for any of the package management systems. Those are just some of my practical steps. It's a broad topic. I'm actually going to be giving a talk about this at the HelloConf later this which is an online virtual conference later this this month. So
okay.
I'll be unpacking this more.
Let me find that. What is the conference called? Or can you give a URL or just something?
Yeah,
to
let
Google?
Me find it real quick. I just got the acceptance like today.
Okay. Yeah, because it would be cool to give people a chance to go check out this talk if they can.
Sure.
I'm not going to talk about Legos again while Frank finds the link. I'm just going to mumble incoherently for as long as I possibly can about no particular thing. I'm just going to say words until Frank tells me that he is ready with the link.
No, I don't see that there's a website for it. What on earth?
Huh.
I'll find it after the show and we'll get it linked, okay?
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, Frank, I think with all those tips you just gave us about what we can do is a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for providing that advice. Where are some places that people can find more about you online?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, the best place by far is Rietta.com, R-I-E-T-T-A.com. There you will find the blog that I've been publishing since 2005. And you can actually subscribe to a newsletter that I'm in the process of restarting, which is going to be a monthly on, what did I call it? It's going to be a monthly on the technical and policy trends in web security. So hopefully those are useful resources. I'm on Twitter. You can find me at Frank Rietta on Twitter. You can search on LinkedIn and find me, but that's not nearly as cool as interacting with the blog. And I'm always happy to answer questions. And I have been doing this a long time, and I intend to do this for a very long time. I am not one of these sales-oriented professionals. I'm all about how do we make people more secure? How do we fix software security? And how do we get developers to know how to do their job in a way that produces more secure software?
Well, Frank, once again, this has been extremely, not only educational, but I dare say entertaining. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Jason.